to argue that the double is not colorably different.
Exactly, because I think we've already run this race and carried our burden, and we ought to be in a position to just do that by a contempt motion. And if he says it's more than colorably different, fine. You know, we then could proceed with another complaint if we really believe strongly.
Or with an appeal to this court.
Or appeal to this court. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel. The case is submitted. Your argument next in number 2012-1183, Ritz Camera against SanDisk Corporation. Very well, Mr. Kennedy.
May it please the court. As we know, in the first paragraph in Section 2 of the Walker Process Opinion, the court found that the patent infringement defendant counterclaimant in that case had the right to pursue an antitrust claim based on the intentional fraudulent procurement of the patent. The court, however, did not stop there and say reversed and remanded. It went on to include a further paragraph explaining that its holding was in accord with five of its earlier decisions. Those five, of course, included the Keystone trilogy, as well as a debt relief action and a patent misuse case, Mercoid. All five of those cases found there was the right to challenge a patent on the basis of the unclean hands doctrine. In fact, I believe four of the five actually mentioned the doctrine by name. So the question up before this court today is obviously, does that Walker Process holding extend to a litigant such as Ritz, who has not been sued for patent infringement, is incapable of being sued since they bought from us, and has never been threatened with patent infringement?
But didn't Hydrol pretty much reject what you're arguing now?
I don't believe so at all, Your Honor. In fact, if Hydrol were accepting Ritz's position, I think Hydrol could have been a far shorter opinion.
Well, it appeared to say that the standard for Article III jurisdiction or declaratory judgment action challenging the enforceability of a patent is whether the declaratory judgment plaintiff was under threat of suit, which of course is a standard that has since been changed as a result of the Supreme Court's decision in Medimon. But at the time, Hydrol was assuming that was the standard for declaratory judgments, and they said, well, that's maybe the case, but we're not extending that to the antitrust area.
I agree with everything Your Honor has said, and I want to make clear, we are not claiming that for a litigant such as Ritz, who has no risk of patent infringement, that declaratory relief should provide any kind of a standard. We perhaps went further than we should have in our opening brief in trying to propose a standard for people who were being sued or did face risk. We're not claiming that a declaratory judgment standard applies.
What is the standard then?
Our position is, one, if as we believe, Walker Process is rooted in the equitable doctrine of unclean hands, then Ritz is seeking an impermissible extension of that doctrine, and that's illustrated by the Grupo versus Alliance case that's cited at page 11 of our reply brief, that federal equity jurisdiction is limited to what was available in 1789.
But they're not relying on federal equity jurisdiction, they're relying on the antitrust laws. Statutory cause of action.
So alternatively, to the extent the court concludes that that's the basis, despite the second paragraph in Section 2, submit at a minimum Walker process is uncertain, not just to the right that's being granted, but as to who has the right to assert that right. And I think that's the reason 47 years later we're here with conflicting... Sorry, Your Honor, I thought you were about to ask a question.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Why 47 years later we have not only conflicting district court opinions, but DDAVP saying we're not sure exactly what they meant, and therefore we have to go to this tarnished patent compromise.
What about the fact that in Walker process, those very plaintiffs could not have actually been sued for infringement, and the Supreme Court was aware of that, yet they went ahead and decided the case?
But, Your Honor, those particular plaintiffs were, I submit, able to be sued and were being sued.
At the time they brought the suit, but not at the time that the Supreme Court was deciding it, so why wouldn't the subsequent actions, i.e. the dismissal of the DJ and all that other stuff, have divested the court of jurisdiction?
Oh, because before the plaintiff had dismissed their affirmative claims, Walker had amended to assert the antitrust claim. Because remember, the plaintiff's claims and
yes, but your standing can change throughout a litigation, right? It's not just standing on the day of the litigation. If your argument is correct, that only if you are a person who could be sued for infringement may you bring this litigation, then your argument also has to be, also if you're a person who could be sued for infringement, can you proceed through this litigation? Standing is not assessed only on the day you bring suit, correct?
Understood, Your Honor, but in this case, they were sued for patent infringement, they asserted the claim while they were still being sued for patent infringement.
Yes,
I think under rule,
but before it got to the Supreme Court, all of that was gone, and they could no longer be sued for patent infringement, as the Supreme Court acknowledged. So, why is it still in play?
Well, I did not read the case saying the Supreme Court acknowledged they could no longer be sued. In fact, I don't think that issue was even raised.
Well,
but
it could have been dismissed with prejudice, right? So, and the court acknowledged the dismissal.
To be sure, but they had their claim to harm. They raised the antitrust claim before those claims were dismissed. And I submit under Rule 41, a plaintiff who decides they've got a bad case but doesn't like the counterclaim, maybe they can make the deck relief go away, but they can't make the whole case go away. In fact, the U.S. rubber decision that's relied on heavily by our opponents makes that point. Remember, that's exactly what was attempted in U.S. rubber.
It strikes me that language that, I mean, you rely on some language from Walker process, but the language that caught my eye that seems to me to be applicable here and does not seem to predicate Walker process actions on being brought by someone who is a potential accused infringer in a patent law action is the language that starts. The gist of Walker's claim is that since Food Machinery's obtained its patent by fraud, it cannot enjoy limited exception to the prohibitions of Section 2 of the Sherman Act, but must answer under that section and Section 4 of the Clayton Act to those injured by any monopolistic action taken under the fraudulent patent claim. So what the court, to my read, seems to be saying is we are looking at this as an antitrust claim brought by someone who has antitrust standing, and if they do, they can win their case if they can prove that that patent does not erect a defense of a state-authorized monopoly. And the way they do that is by showing that it meets the Walker standard fraud, procured by fraud standard. Why doesn't that answer fully the question of whether someone with antitrust standing gets to bring a Walker process type action, even if that party could not bring a DJ under the Patent Act?
For two reasons, at least. First, I submit under the facts of Walker process, the court was dealing with a traditional patent defendant.
It was, but my point to you is this language sounds like it is not. It is the court explaining the rationale for its decision, which is to say this is an antitrust case. This is a Section 2 case brought under Section 4, and as such, a party needs to be an antitrust plaintiff but doesn't need to have anything more than that in order to prove its case, as long as it can show that the patent was fraudulently procured.
If that's the way the court reads the language, I can't say that's an irrational way to go, we lose.
Well, but why is it not only not irrational, but why isn't that the natural meaning of the phrases, the words I just read from the opinion?
Again, if that occurred in isolation, if they'd said reversed and remanded after that, I'd have I'd sit down. We wouldn't be here. But the court didn't stop at that point, and this all arose in context of a world where there had been no right whatsoever. Where there had been no right whatsoever to choose patents, and the court had reached out to find the unclean hands doctrine, and it's deciding the case in context of a traditional context that they had before. And for all the reasons that other courts, including in particular the Second Circuit, have said, there's something here that doesn't seem to really clarify whether they intended to open the, I submit, floodgates that would result from this. As I said, clearly the language can be read the way Your Honor has suggested, and if that's it, at least this court can provide needed clarification and we can stop having judges trying to figure out.
Do you question whether or not there's antitrust injury here for standing purpose, or do you believe your appeal is just limited to this first issue?
Well, the appeal is limited just to the first issue, Your Honor. We have challenged the antitrust injury, but we did not seek interlocutory relief from that.
You speak about the floodgates, and I'm always skeptical of floodgates arguments because they're made frequently and they often turn out not to produce very much by way of a flood, even if the gates are left open or opened by the court.
But I realize it's not an original line with me, Your Honor.
It is not, but it's been used frequently and I think often not persuasively. And I'm skeptical here because this is an area which, as you yourself have said, it's not as if we're being asked to suddenly change the law. There's certainly some support for the proposition in past cases that someone with only antitrust standing can bring such an action, and yet we haven't had so many of these cases. Indeed, it's striking to me that this is the first time that this court has at least directly confronted this issue. So I'm wondering about where is this flood that you're talking about, and in as much as, you know, there's certainly plaintiffs have had this door open to them, at least in part, in the past.
Well, I think it's, again, perhaps a two-part answer. One, I think with the division, I think the majority of the district courts rejecting this claim, it's taken a fairly aggressive plaintiff's lawyer to be wanting to expend resources here.
Those are hard to find, aren't they?
I think putting this court's imprimatur on it, and think what that will do. Everybody who files a patent infringement suit will face the risk of a willful procurement claim, not only by their competitors, but by all of their customers and direct purchasers as well. And we're going to have a bar that's going to be incentivized not only by the ability to use...
Well, but isn't Walker process limited to fraud, which is something even worse than inequitable conduct? Right? And haven't we, in Theracense, made inequitable conduct what seems to be virtually impossible to prove now? So where is the flood? I mean, if anything, I'm not sure there's even a drip in the faucet.
Well, I hope you're right. However, I'm a little concerned that, as has been done in this case, somebody goes and finds some prior art and then says one of the patentees knew something about it, and then I think we're going to hear, oh, we now have an intent issue, which can only be resolved after a full-blown trial and isn't susceptible to summary judgment. So I think under Theracense, the chances of ultimately winning may be quite low. The prospects of losing are still going to be enormous, and the pressure to settle is still going to be there.
Walker process itself addressed this argument and specifically rejected it on page 176. Nor can the interest in protecting patentees from innumerable vexatious suits be used to frustrate the assertion of rights conferred by the antitrust law. The same argument was made there and rejected, right?
That, of course, is assuming the court was envisioning that it was vesting rights in purchasers, other people beyond consumers, and foresaw what was going to happen with class actions and the law over the next 40 years. I'm not sure all of that can necessarily be assumed, but that language is there to be sure.
Okay, why don't we save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Okay,
thank
you.
And we'll hear from Mr. Hall first, and then Ms. Lamarzi. Is that the sequence?
Joseph Hall for the appellees, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Walker Process struck the proper balance between antitrust and patent law by recognizing that fraudulently procured patents provide no antitrust immunity. SanDisk argues here that Walker Process claims are available only to plaintiffs who face the risk of patent infringement claims. On their facts, however, four cases squarely reject that limitation. The Supreme Court in Walker Process, this Court's opinion in Hydril, the Second Circuit in INRI DDABP, and the D.C. Circuit's opinion in Edeker. SanDisk's new rule for Walker Process standing also flies in the face of over 100 years of Supreme Court antitrust precedent, establishing that direct purchasers, such as RITs, are preferred plaintiffs for Section 2 Act Sherman claims and Section 4 Clayton Act claims. Judge Fogelblow properly concluded that RITs have standing under Walker Process and the antitrust laws, and this Court should affirm.
What's your position, I'll put it that way, on the tarnished patent codicil that's attached in some of these cases to the doctrine of antitrust standing being sufficient?
Your Honor, there's only two cases, first of all, that I'm aware of that have a tarnishing.
This one is one of them.
This one is one of them. But, and certainly Judge Fogel in this case relied on DDAVP. I think there's no legal, regulatory, statutory, or any jurisprudential basis for imposing such requirement as a matter of law. As an operative matter, as a practical matter, I think what has happened is because it's so very hard to prove fraud, because discovery is required, typically there has been a prior proceeding. In fact, I've been able to find no Walker Process case in which there hasn't been a prior proceeding that would have uncovered the fraud. So I think operatively there's always going to have been some prior proceeding, but there's no basis in law for imposing such a requirement. Let me first explain why SanDisk's new limitation on Walker Process standing has already been rejected by the Supreme Court and three courts of appeals, including this one. Every argument raised by SanDisk here was heard and rejected by the Supreme Court in Walker Process. Like Food Machinery, the counterclaimant in Walker Process, SanDisk contends that fraudulent procurement of a patent is an equitable doctrine and that there are strict limits on who can challenge a patent. In reversing the Seventh Circuit's decision, the Court acknowledged both of those arguments before holding that, quote, neither reason applies here. The Court held that Walker Process claims arise under the antitrust laws, not the patent laws, and seek money damages, not equitable relief. SanDisk's argument wants the Court to ignore everything in Walker Process except for the phrase long-recognized procedures. SanDisk is simply wrong about the import of this phrase, however. First, in context, the meaning of long-recognized procedures is clear. The Seventh Circuit had a firm dismissal of Walker Process's antitrust claims because the government, not private parties, had authority to maintain an action to invalidate a patent. The Supreme Court rejected that argument because A, Walker Process's claims did not directly seek to invalidate a patent, and B, there were several contexts in which private parties could already challenge a patent's validity. SanDisk simply wants to rewrite the antecedent phrase accords with to read arises from in order to create a limitation where none exists. Second, the Court addressed SanDisk's standing argument that allowing the private parties to challenge fraudulently procured patents could result in innumerable vexatious suits. The Court rejected that argument out of hand, holding that those concerns cannot, quote, frustrate the assertion of rights conferred by the antitrust laws.
Can I throw in a separate question here that hasn't really been, well, it's been alluded to, but it hasn't really been fully addressed. Does this case belong here or in the Ninth Circuit, in your view?
In our view, Your Honor, it belongs to the Ninth Circuit. However, I think the en banc determination by Noble Pharma places Walker Process's cases within the jurisdiction of this court.
But you think that Noble Pharma is probably wrong?
That's correct, Your Honor.
In a matter of federal jurisdiction?
Under Christensen, that's correct, Your Honor, but I believe it's binding.
And the arising under it clearly doesn't fall within the well-pleaded complaint part of the arising under doctrine, right?
That's correct.
And so the question is, does it fall in under the second prong of Franchise Tax Board?
Right.
Right? And just very briefly, why not?
Why doesn't it? Well, I mean, first of all, you could certainly imagine cases in which there would be no need to prove fraud on the PTO in order to prevail on a Walker process claim. For instance, if you had a prior determination, which under Blondertongue would be res judicata or collateral estoppel on the patentee, that Walker process case would involve solely issues of antitrust law. And so the notion that all Walker process cases should come to this court because they necessarily involve patent determination, I think, speaks too broadly. Moreover, this is actually a defense.
Well, there's no such determination here.
That's correct, Your Honor. I was simply addressing the broader notion from Judge Bryson that
let's stick to this case.
Okay.
If this case were to go to the Supreme Court, what would be the right analysis of the Franchise Tax Board Part 2 arising under jurisprudence?
Our claims here arise under the antitrust laws. They were pleaded under 28 U.S.C. 1336.
Don't they involve a substantial question of patent law,
given that
there has been no determination of inequitable conduct on
it? That's the second prong.
Right, but that arises as a defense, Your Honor, not a necessary predicate of
the claim. Yeah, but Franchise Tax Board is saying there are some cases that aren't well-pleaded complaint arising under, but still arise under because they involve important, significant, major pieces of federal, and in this case, patent law, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so why isn't this one of them?
I think, Your Honor, because there are, first of all, it is unusual to me as a doctrine of federal court that a defense, even if it necessarily involves questions of patent law, you can certainly conceive of contracts, for instance, that would involve questions of patent law that nonetheless would be straight contract actions. It's not sufficient to invoke the jurisdiction of this court, that the issue simply touch on or even involve.
Why is it just a question of defense? I mean, in order to prove your Walker process claim, you've got to prove fraud on the patent law. And so in order to recover under the Walker process claim, you have to establish something that's entirely dependent on the issue of patent law, no?
I think that's operatively true, Your Honor. But I think as a matter of, and how you normally would look at questions of federal jurisdiction, we raise a Section 4 Act and a Section 2 Act claim. The defense of that.
They would defend with the
defense of that, exactly, is we have a valid
patent.
Right, and then we would come back and the burden has shifted. But as a matter of federal court's jurisdiction, I don't think you can look necessarily to the defense in before it's been raised. Even though operatively, I would acknowledge that in Walker process cases, that's almost
that
always going
to be
occur.
Rejecting Franchise Tax Board, but never mind.
No problem.
Finally, Your Honor, I just wanted to address one thing that all of you had noted, this notion of the floodgates. Academic review of Walker process cases since the decision in 1965, in the 37 years since Walker process was decided up to 2002, there were 3 successful Walker process cases. Nonetheless, the patent holders have continually argued this would open the floodgates. After INRI DDAVP, which has now been on the books for almost 3 years, there have been 4 antitrust cases that cite DDAVP of this which is one, and 2 of those have been dismissed on antitrust standing grounds. So there simply is not a flood of cases either after Walker process, after INRI DDAVP. Indeed, the structural limitations on bringing these cases, the necessary requirement that you prove fraud with particularity, the fact that you have to have a market where there is no readily available economic or technological substitute means that the number of cases that are likely to fall into the Walker process rubric are quite rare. When they do arise, however, I think that they present substantial harm that was of the very type that the antitrust laws were meant to remedy. If you have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Then we'll hear from Ms. Lamarzi.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court? I'd like to return to where Mr. Kennedy began, which is the inequitable conduct cases, and just talk a little bit about what the Supreme Court was doing with those cases. The Supreme Court didn't cite those inequitable conduct cases to define the class of plaintiffs that could bring this monopolization claim, just like they didn't cite them to adopt the substantive conduct standard, which for Walker process claims is not inequitable conduct, but knowing an intentional fraud.
What's the difference?
What is the difference between inequitable...
The substantive standard.
Well, I believe this court's addressed that distinction in other cases, but it's not something on which the government has a position what the difference is between those two standards. And it's not presented in this case, since there's no dispute in this appeal that RIST has adequately alleged the fraud element of a Walker Process claim, as well as the other elements. But what the Supreme Court was doing when citing those inequitable conduct cases is using them as examples of suits in which patent validity is an issue, and yet the suit doesn't run afoul of the ban on private suits to cancel or annul. That's what the court is saying when it says the monopolization claim before it accords with these long-recognized procedures, the procedures that allow private parties to litigate patent validity in the context of other actions. And that was the mistake the Seventh Circuit had made and that the Supreme Court was correcting. And I'll note it's not a mystery where the court got those inequitable conduct cases. They're taken directly out of the government's brief in Walker Process, where they're cited for precisely this point. And moreover, I think as Judge Bryson alluded to, the language of the remainder of Walker Process decision makes quite clear the court understood that these monopolization claims weren't limited to particular classes of plaintiffs. Both the question presented and the holding make specific reference to Section 4 of the Clayton Act, which authorizes suit by any person injured by a violation. And they're phrased in terms of the treble damage remedy available to an injured party, not available to a competitor, not the remedy available to someone sued for patent infringement, but an injured party. And RIST alleges it is such an injured party. It also has, according to the district court, adequately alleged the remainder of the elements of a Walker Process violation, which I think, Judge Moore, you referenced, are erect significant hurdles to weed out meritless claims.
And isn't the case law quite clear that antitrust injury is commonly suffered by purchasers?
Yes, of course. That's the reason direct purchasers are the quintessential antitrust.
Not the competitor injury.
No, certainly not. The broad remedial language of Section 4 of the Clayton Act reflects the fact that the primary purpose of that remedy is to provide a remedy to purchasers who pay overcharges because of anti-competitive conduct. I mean, that's the reason direct purchasers are sort of the archetypal antitrust plaintiff. So imposing the limit that Sandisk proposes, barring all these monopolization claims by direct purchasers, I think would rewrite the Clayton Act, which provides this remedy to any person injured by an antitrust violation. And it also runs counter to decades of Supreme Court cases rejecting these sorts of artificial limits, and we cited to Ryder v. Sonatone, which I think is a good example of this in our brief. Briefly, just to address the tarnishment issue, I think for the same reasons that direct purchaser standing for the same reasons that there's no basis in the case law or the statute to ban direct purchaser suits, I think there's similarly no basis to make direct purchaser standing dependent on the patent's tarnishment. The requirement lacks any principled basis, and worse, it makes the remedy for injured direct purchasers depend on the outcome of suits to which they're not a party. For this reason, if the court determines it has jurisdiction, the government has urged the court to hold that direct purchasers who adequately plead the elements of Walker Process claim, including, of course, knowing an intentional fraud on the Patent Office, that those plaintiffs can bring that claim without regard to whether the patent's been tarnished in another proceeding. And if the court has no further questions.
I think you probably covered this point.
Does the government have any position on the jurisdictional question and whether a franchise tax board in particular?
The government has no position on the jurisdiction question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kennedy, we used up a lot of your time. We'll give you a couple of minutes to rebuttal this.
Since this appears to be an appeal, I can't win, but a case my client can't lose. Unless the court has questions, I'm prepared to submit at this point and get back to focusing on the merits.
Okay. I don't think we have any further questions, so thank you, and we thank all counsel. The case is